Yeah, so this has a previous version of this game somewhat, so hopefully he won't be too bored, and as the rest of you won't be bored either. I will say first that I have a tendency to speak very fast, particularly when I'm presenting, which can be a problem for native English speakers, and I think for people with second language, it can be even more of a problem. So if I start to speed up and you really can't understand what I'm saying, please just interrupt and tell me. So the research work that I'm presenting here is really sort of a combination of two threads of research that I've been doing over the past couple of years, which I tried to bring together rather messily in this presentation. Essentially looking at the political economy of conflict, and particularly separatist movements. And this research has had two strands. The first has been quantitative work, looking at building econometric models of conflict incidents, separatist conflict around the world, where my main motivation there was dissatisfaction with the orthodox models of conflict. If any of you know it, there's quite a wide econometric literature looking at the causes of political economy, causes of conflict, civil wars and such, which tends to look at the national level, so look at national level economic data, political systems and such, which seems to me highly inappropriate for looking at separatist movements. So I tried to disaggregate this kind of work to a sub-national level. So I'll be drawing partly on that. And then also some more sort of qualitative work looking at four cases in Southeast Asia. And there's a lot of separatist activity in Southeast Asia compared to other regions of the world. In the most commonly used data set of conflicts that try to catalogue wars and conflicts around the world, four of the 10 longest running wars in the world have been separatist movements in South and Southeast Asia. So in general, separatist movements separatist wars tend to be much longer than normal wars, and also they are particularly prevalent in this part of the world. Having said that, I find that the existing literature on the separatism in Southeast Asia largely ignores the political economy aspect of conflict, political economy roots of conflict. And focuses on political and historical factors, which are very important, but I feel they miss an important part of the picture. So what I'm trying to do is sort of find the middle ground. On the one hand, sort of put the local into the quantitative work, and on the other hand, try and put the political economy into the qualitative work on Southeast Asia. So I do this presentation in different places, so I have a map. Not many people in Europe are so familiar with Southeast Asia, but I think I can quickly whip through these are just the four cases that I will be focusing on. The first is Patani, or Southern Thailand, for most people outside of Thailand. Patani is the name that rings a bell. Some brief details: Malay Muslim minority concentrated in three provinces, relatively poor area that has historic links with the Malay Peninsula. Now, at this stage, I also want to make a caveat and say that this is really the case that I know least about, which is both a defense against any difficult questions that come up, but also, in a sense, this is what I would really like help with from you, is seeing whether the story I tell seems to fit the Southern Thailand experience, as people here who are probably much more familiar with it than I am. The second case is Mindanao in the southern Philippines, where there's again a Muslim minority concentrated in four regions in the southern part of the Philippines. Again, it's a relatively poor area, and it has historic links with Borneo and Brunei. The third case I'll be focusing on is Aceh, where you have an ethnic minority rather than a religious minority. I mean, in southern Thailand, obviously, there's an ethno-religious element, both Malay and Muslim. Similar things can be said in southern Thailand. In Aceh, the distinguishing feature of the insurgent group is much more ethnically delimited. Although the interpretation of Islam that's been prevalent in Aceh over the past century or so has been much more orthodox than in the rest of Indonesia. So in that sense, there are important religious differences of interpretation rather than sort of bland schools. It's also different in that, although it's relatively poor in a way that I will go into in detail further, it has significant oil and gas reserves, which make it a potentially very wealthy area. And again, it has strong historical links with different areas, the Malay Peninsula, and even the Ottoman Empire in the grand old days of the Achaemenid Sultanate. As a little sort of side, I noticed when I was doing this that all these cases lie on this parallel here, and that if you follow this parallel westward, you come across Sri Lanka, Eritrea, southern Cote d'Ivoire, and a host of other separatist cases around the world. So I'm tempted to suggest simply that this parallel here is a separatist parallel, but I thought that would be a rather short and uninteresting presentation, so I'll stick to my old presentation. The final case I'm looking at is Sabah in Malaysia, the state of Sabah, which is not separatist, and this was a particular thing that I wanted to include, in that I feel that a lot of the comparative work that does look at separatist movements tends to compare just those separatist movements without any attempt at sort of a counterfactual, as it were. So Sabah is my counterfactual case because it shares many characteristics with the separatist regions that I've identified, both these and other areas such as Papua and areas in Burma that I won't be looking at so closely today. It's ethnically distinct, it's a relatively poor area and has a very different historical trajectory from West Malaysia. So I will be looking at Sabah throughout as a kind of a comparator which has not experienced violence, although it has on a number of occasions experienced political demands for separation from the rest of Malaysia. This has never escalated into violent conflict.
Well, just to tell you that you don't have to worry about writing down the presentation, because we will upload the PowerPoint file to the faculty website later. All right. Okay.
There's also a paper that goes behind this, which I'm happy to distribute afterwards to anyone who wants. So I'm going to focus on four broad areas in this presentation, which necessitates a turn of speed. The first is what I've called here geography, but it's really more sort of historical geography, political geography, processes of state formation and border drawing. The second issue is demography, state migration policies and minoritization issues. Economics, particularly the concept of horizontal inequalities, which I will deal with a bit when I come there. And finally, the political dimensions of separatism. These obviously are overlapping areas. I don't intend them to be sort of a neat little cells, but just sort of areas of focus. Now, in terms of the political geography of separatism, it hardly comes as a surprise, I think, to say that most separatist movements occur on what I've termed ethnic peripheries, which is to say geographical regions that are often on the border area, almost always. Nagorno-Karabakh in Azerbaijan is an interesting example of a separatist movement that actually is totally enclosed by the parent country, which it is. But other than this, separatist movements tend to occur on national borders with ethnic groups distinct from the titular nation state, or titular national group, I should say. But what I tried to do in some of the quantitative work I was looking at is just see how far this simple aspect of demographic difference can account for the incidence of separatist movements. Now, there's been a lot of work done looking at the relationship between ethnic diversity, ethnic polarization, and the incidence of conflict at the national level by people like Paul Collier, also at Oxford, and Margarino Quirrell in Barcelona. University. And they've developed various measures, essentially concentration indices of ethnic dispersion at the national levels, to try and see how far this relates to the incidence of conflict. And broadly speaking, they find very poor relationships, either no relationship at all or very weak, statistically insignificant relationships. But by reducing the unit of analysis to the subnational level, and in particular I take what was termed the primary administrative division, so that's the state and the federal system, the province in Thailand, for instance, regions in the Philippines, whatever the next level down is from the state, and looking at census data for ethnic and religious differences at this more localized level, we can produce this measure of subnational group difference, I term it, which is essentially a measure that shows how far each subnational unit differs demographically in terms of ethnicity and religion from the rest of the country. And the scale here would vary from 0 to 1. So 0 would be a case where the demographic distribution of the subnational units exactly match that of the rest of the country, and 1 would be where you had an exact mismatch. So for instance, if 100% of Achenese lived in Aceh, and there were 0 Achenese, or if Aceh was entirely populated by Achenese, and there were no Achenese outside of Aceh, then Aceh province would score 1. More intuitively, the measure gives the percentage of the population who would have to convert in some sense, whether religiously or ethnically, to match, for the province to match the rest of the country. Now if we look, I've done this for about 100 countries, 104 countries around the world, which gives us about 5,000 cases. And if we look at the distribution of these primary administrative divisions in terms of the maximum subnational group difference, so this is taking both religion and ethnicity and looking at where the variance is greatest, then this gives you the sort of broad distribution of all the cases around the world. If we limit it to those cases which at any time in the post-Second World War era have experienced some degree of violent separatism, we can see that it draws a very different curve. And in fact, we can plot lines of best fit, one of which is logarithmic, one of which is almost the inverse curve. I mean, if you plot the inverse curve of one of these, it comes very close to the other. Another way of looking at this data is to present it in terms of quantiles. So I simply took the 20 quantiles of this measure of difference and looked at the annual probability. Probability is not a good word, it implies prediction, but the annual incidence of separatist conflict in each of these quantiles of regional difference. And you can see not only is there a positive relationship, unsurprisingly, but it's actually a very sharp upward turn at around potentially the top quartile rather than, or the top four quintiles, certainly, top four quintiles of ethnic difference. The little bulge down here is a bit of a data problem because it is largely accounted for by the Chittagong Hill Tracts in Bangladesh, where I only had religious data, which Chittagong is largely religiously homogenous with the rest of Bangladesh, but has very different ethnic makeup. So if we were to divide the ethnic data as well, then this one would sort of be trashed up here as well, somewhere around here. So there's a clear clustering of separatism in these distinct regions, these ethnic peripheries. But obviously it's not universal. I mean, you have a 10% incidence at best. And just to have a sort of an idea, I have to apologize now. This I think the translation from an English computer to a Thai computer has confused the fonts somewhat, so it's not always clear. But these are some of the sort of top scoring regions, as it were, that we might expect to experience separatism given this measure. But we have not experienced separatism on the data set that we have, and I just wanted to point a few characteristics. First of all, some of these areas are areas which have experienced quite significant violence, but are not usually classified in sort of common data sets of conflict as separatist wars. for the Northwest 20th Province and the federally administrative tribal areas of Pakistan have both experienced quite significant anti-state violence. And the Katibi region of Namibia in southern Africa has also experienced quite extensive anti-state violence, although it hasn't mobilized to the extent of other wars. The second sort of broad group of non-cases are areas which are ethnically homogenous, ethnically distinct, but are also areas populated by the group that has national dominance, so they have little incentive to secede. So the Javanese in Indonesia, for instance, are concentrated on the island of Java, and the Tigre in Ethiopia, although they're a very small minority, are politically dominant in Ethiopia. And finally, just the predominance of Indonesian provinces in this data set is largely because Indonesia is actually a bit of an outlier in terms of ethnic segregation, which is in effect what we're measuring here. I mean, the province-level ethnic segregation in Indonesia is something quite extraordinary compared to other countries. India is really the only country which comes anywhere close. You can see a couple of Indian examples there. But Indonesia really has a very high level of ethnic segregation at the provincial level, as it indeed also has had a high incidence of separatist movements, both contemporary and historically. So this thing is all really very nice, but it doesn't tell us very much about separatism, I think. It feeds into sort of a broader framework, which I'll come to later. But if our answer is just that different people want to be independent, then that's kind of a little bit of a non sequitur. So what I want to look at really is looking at, first of all, the why question of how these ethnic peripheries came about in the process of state formation. And looking particularly at the sort of Southeast Asian experience here, I think we can identify quite a clear trend, historical trajectory, which explains the sort of the existence of these ethnic peripheries in the modern nation states. If we look at sort of the literature on pre-colonial state formation in Southeast Asia, the sort of predominant model is an idea of this mandala policy, which is the closest approximation to the idea of a state, but that it doesn't really correspond to our concept of a modern nation state. They were rather centers of influence, spheres of influence, characterized by tributary relationships, which often were amorphous, with porous borders, peripheral areas, often owing allegiance to several different mandala. Angkor Wat is an example of one of these mandala, also in the sort of archipelagic Southeast Asia, Majapahit on Java. And one of the key geographic features here was mountains as boundaries. Mountains formed natural borders in the pre-colonial era. Traversing mountains was impossible, particularly during the wet season. So if you look at some of the sort of upland folk in Burma, the Wa and the Shan, they remain largely immune from the aggression and the expansion of polities, both in the pre-colonial and in the colonial and in the post-colonial era, precisely because of the mountainous terrain that separates them from other groups. With the colonial period, you see the introduction of hard borders, center-periphery relationships which are much more organized, where one unit is typically tied into a relationship with one polity, central policy, whether colonial or a colonial stooge, as in some of the unfederated Malay states in Malaya, for instance. And a crucial distinction is that for the colonial powers, water became a much more natural boundary for them than mountains. And these water boundaries actually often cut across the old cultural political links of pre-colonial Southeast Asia. And a very good example here is Aceh, which in the pre-colonial era was very much part of the Malay world, which the Malay world roughly was along the eastern side of Sumatra and the western side of Malaya. And there's the Malacca Straits in the middle, but for the pre-colonial era, the Malacca Straits were far less of a boundary for the communication and the expansion of cultural and political and trade networks than the big mountains in the middle of Malaya and the big mountains in the middle of Sumatra, because these were intraversible. In contrast, when the colonial powers came, in terms of sort of divvying up the world between the Dutch and the British, as it was in this case, the Malacca Strait was a much more useful boundary point because it could be policed by warships. It was very clear, it was a hard border. And so you have this kind of bifurcation of old cultural and political networks by the logic of colonial map-making. And the finishing touches, really, I've sort of put on this in the post-colonial era, where the particular nature of the state that finally emerged was driven much more, not so much by colonial interactions, but by the geopolitics of the post-Second World War era, and in particular the emergence of the Cold War. So that, for instance, the inclusion of Sabah into Malaysia, in the formation of Malaysia in 1965. So for those without the history of Malaysia, Malaya, the peninsula, gained independence in 1957. And in 1963, Malaya was expanded to include the East Malaysian states of Sabah and Sarawak and Singapore, which left rather rapidly afterwards. The inclusion of East Malaysian states was very much a matter of geopolitics, and essentially the British, who retained control over Singapore and East Malaysia, were very concerned by the rise of communism in Singapore, and asked the Malayan government to incorporate Singapore within the Malayan Federation as a way to neutralize this communist contagion. But this would have countered the weight of the Chinese population of Singapore is so dominant that the Malayan government were very concerned that the increase in the Chinese population, if they included Singapore, would effectively make the Chinese rather than the Malays the masters of Malaya. So their price to the British for accepting Singapore was to include also the East Malaysian states of Sabah and Sarawak, which are much more indigenous dominated. And if you look, I went and looked at the sort of the colonial records and the discussions amongst the colonial officials concerning the Malaysia plan, and there's a very clear transition from the early days when the idea was first promoted before Singapore started its wayward path towards communism, that the British officials in Southeast Asia and in London were very much opposed to any idea of a greater Malaysia, because they saw this sort of ethnic periphery issue of Sabah and Sarawak being ethnically distinct from the Malays, religiously distinct from the Malays, and essentially they were worried about the creation of an ethnic problem. Over time, when it becomes clear that the bargain on offer from Tunku Abdul Rahman, the Prime Minister of Malaya, is all or nothing, very explicitly the British logic, defence requirements take over, and this ethnic issue is pushed to the side, and the requirement of neutralizing the rise of communism in Singapore becomes much more important in the British logic. I'm going very slowly, I've got a lot more to get through. So I will tell you that essentially similar processes can be seen in terms of the process of granting independence to Mindanao, to the Philippines, and the transition in American thinking from the proposal of the army which retained control over Mindanao for much of the 20th century, and their plans for Mindanao was to turn it into essentially the same kind of protectorate that Hawaii was at the time, that there would be an outside American station in Southeast Asia, whilst the rest of the Philippines was to be granted independence. But again, it was domestic politics in Washington rather than any kind of concern over local, the nature of the nation-state or the non-nation-state that was being created in the process of decolonization that led the Americans in the end to include Mindanao in the independent Philippines that was granted independence in the 1940s. So that's one aspect of why these ethnic peripheries have emerged. And the other thing that I wanted to look at was how this particular issue of sort of ethnic distinction has been used by separatist movements in trying to mobilize support for their causes. Because it's one thing to say that ethnic peripheries are an important, a necessary but not sufficient, if you like, condition for separatist movements. But how this is utilized, why those cases don't emerge in other areas which have ethnic distinction, such as Saba. And so I tend to look at the way in which the separatist movements themselves describe their struggle, their campaigns. And this is just some excerpts from some of the sort of propaganda documents, declarations of independence, speeches by prominent groups or individuals. And really what I wanted to draw attention to, what I noticed when I was going through this, was the incredible similarity of language in terms of the presentation of these ethno-histories of the ASNLS is the Free Aceh movement, is their political wing. Nur Mitwari is was for a long time, the sort of the ideologue and guru of the Mindanao movement. Wan Abdul Chairman, probably people here are familiar with, activists come, scholar of southern Thailand, and also this is an example from at the bottom from Sri Lanka, the Tamil Tigers. And it's this language of since the world has begun, as long as history goes back throughout centuries from the dawn of history, this sort of presentation of their ethnic claims as something natural, timeless and legitimate, which is often counterposed against the modernity and illegitimacy of the modern nation state. Now what's interesting also about these is the extent to which they make claims back to pre-colonial policies. In Aceh you have the link to the Aceh Sultanate, which was a very powerful Sultanate in the region, as I said before, with links to the Ottoman Empire. In southern Philippines, you had two major Islamic sultanates, Maguindanao and the Sulu Sultanate, both of which were very influential. In southern Thailand, you have the Pattani Kingdom, and in Sri Lanka, they made claims to the old Kingdom of Jaffna, the Tamil Kingdom of Jaffna. And these appeal to pre-colonial policies, which, as this is not my work at all, I don't want to claim credit for what's mine, but what Thomas McKenna has shown very well in the southern Philippines example in particular, is an entirely romanticized and sanitized version of history, in which the feuding and fighting between the southern Philippines sultanate is pasted over in favor of this sort of narrative of a grand unified pre-colonial policy. And it's interesting when we contrast this with Saba. And this is a quote from James Onkili, who's one of the sort of, in the 1980s certainly was one of the foremost Kadazan activists. Kadazan is the largest of the native ethnic groups in Saba, who at various times have called for secession from Malaysia or opposed the formation of Malaysia in the first place. And he's again an academic and a politician. And the contrast here with his really sort of disparaging opinion of his own region's past. There was no community, no overall administration, no state economy, no state government. This sort of depiction, there was nothing there for him to attach a pre-colonial history to. And indeed, I mean, from most of the historical data that's available, it appears that Saba was largely under the influence of either Brunei or the Sulu Sultanate through much of the pre-colonial period. Now the interesting thing is what's happening in Saba now as discontent is emerging, and that various Kadazan leaders are actually in a way trying to invent a past and trying to invent a kingdom which did not exist previously, and in particular this Nunuk Ragan, which is sort of the center of the Kadazan foundational myth. Their genealogical myth is sort of linked to this place in the highlands, Saba, called Nunuk Ragan. But now the Kadazan cultural organizations are trying to imbue this with a kind of a historical king, as a historical kingdom, which from a sort of an objective historical perspective, we can say really is there's very weak evidence for this, but it's creation of a history on which to attach potentially future demands for greater autonomy or some kind of narrative of Sabah separatism, if not secessionism. And so, I should have put this on up earlier. We just see, I mean, part of this narrative then is sort of that most of these movements reject any idea of themselves as separatist or secessionist. They see themselves as resisting colonization. They are simply continuing the process of decolonization. For the Achanese, for instance, they see themselves as being, the Achanese independence movement see themselves as being first colonized by the Dutch and then colonized by the Javanese. In southern Philippines, they put forward this narrative of being first the Spanish attempt to colonize, and then the Americans, and now the Filipinos in Manila are all attempting to colonize them. And again, this narrative is set against sort of what really the sort of historical story. I mean, the claim of a unified pre-colonial policy in the Bangsamoro area. Indeed, the very term that they use for their unified nationality, Bangsamoro, is in itself very telling, because it's a derivation of the Spanish term Moro, which came from the Spanish Moor. The Moro is the Spanish word for Moor, who were the Muslims who invaded the Iberian Peninsula shortly prior to the Spanish, or for a few centuries prior to the Spanish occupation of the Philippines. So it was a very derogatory term, essentially applied to Muslims. But this is the unifying factor for them, in terms of national identity. There is no pre-colonial identity as such in southern Philippines that they could draw upon. And so the name that they have taken, with Bangsa meaning nation in Malay and in most of the southern Mindanao dialect, in the same way that kind of some African Americans have adopted the word nigger as a sort of a positive connotation, they adopted the term Moro and took it on for themselves as their national identity. But this is an identity that was precisely imposed and created by the conditions of colonialism and the experience of Spanish, in particular, colonialism. Now, I think looking at this kind of way that narratives mobilize, groups have mobilized around ethno-historical narratives associated with sort of peripheral status and with pre-colonial kingdoms, can also give us an interesting insight into the particular role of Islam in separatist movements in Southeast Asia, which I think is an important issue to tackle. Because particularly in this day and age, there's a proliferation of work on Islam and violence. And a lot of this work links the Islamic movements in Southeast Asia to some kind of nebulous idea of Al-Qaeda and draw on sort of ideas of networks of fundamentalism and linking people back to various regional groups, various individuals to the mysterious and the ever-present Al-Qaeda. Peter Chalk, Wilhelm Gunaratne, and Zachary Abouza. Many of these people have very little experience in Southeast Asia, but nonetheless write influential books and give testimony to Congress about the nature of Islamic violence in Southeast Asia. These scholars are very dangerous, I think, from various perspectives. They have myopic, ahistorical analyses that are based on very poor, simply inaccurate data. Michael Connors has written a very good deconstruction of this kind of work in southern Thailand. I've looked at some of the work that's been done on Malaysia and Indonesia. And John Siddow has just recently published a sort of an overview of the region looking at these issues. But nonetheless, there is a very strong role for Islam in these movements. And if we want to sort of move away from this kind of alarmist narrative of Islamic fundamentalism, clash of civilizations, to look for a more nuanced and region-specific explanation, then this kind of looking at this kind of ethno-historical narrative gives us an important way in, because we can tie it really to the importance of Islam in early pre-colonial state formation in Southeast Asia. And in the pre-colonial era, the most advanced nation-states, in terms of the policies that most closely resembled what we would today call a state, were very much the Islamic sultanates. And this expansion of Islam through places like Majapahit, Surajaya, not Surajaya, never became Muslim, sorry, but Malacca, Aceh, southern Mindanao, Patani, the expansion of Islam in this pre-colonial era was, the historical consensus is really that it was largely driven simply by trading networks, and in particular that Islam came with essentially a code book for trade, which was very useful for dealing with other countries. So Islam provided a standardized form of international relations, for want of a better reason, for a better term. And it was for this reason that Islam became both very strong and became the font of very strong pre-colonial polities in the Southeast Asian region. And when we now look in the post-colonial era and see that those areas where separatist movements have had the most purchase are those areas where there is some kind of historical claim that can be made to a pre-colonial atavistic glorious past. This provides a sort of an alternative explanation of why we see so much violence associated with Islamic regions of Southeast Asia. Again, I would say also that is by no means only Islamic regions in Southeast Asia that have seen violent separatist movements. Much of the Burmese independence movements, for instance, are not Islamic. I'm really going to have to speed up before you all fall asleep, because I'm now on the second issue, which I'll escape you much quicker. But this is what I do in this section is essentially I look at how these sort of new nation states in the post-colonial era, how they reacted to these problems of the ethnic groupings that they were betrothed by the colonial era. And what I find is that a typical response, both in Southeast Asia and beyond, has been one of promoting state-sponsored migration into these areas, with varying degrees of success and varying scale. But to encourage the immigration of quote-unquote more loyal ethnic citizens, representatives of the nation-state, such as it is, often in the name of development. But this has often had a counterproductive effect in that the development that has come with it has meant essentially the further economic marginalisation of local populations, as migrant groups are often given prime land or prime jobs. And that was typically added to a sense of marginalisation, as well as in many areas, a fear of minoritisation, that they are no longer the masters even of their own region. So I'll just quickly skate through some data showing this trend. The Philippines is the case where it's been most extensive, and both in terms of duration and success, for want of a better term, this minoritization. Such that the Muslim population of Mindanao has dropped from around 90% in 1903 to less than 20%. And this line just shows that as a percentage on the right hand scale. In particular, the 1950s saw a rush, first of all, under the Americans, I should say, in the early years of the 20th century, and then in the 1950s there was another rush of state-sponsored migration, largely in the name of development, opening up new areas for rice cultivation around the Cotabato region, but which drove Muslims into a much more enclave area of Mindanao. So they still remain a majority in four of the regions, but there's around 12 regions in all, I think, in Mindanao, and the rest of these are vast majority Christian. In Aceh, we see a similar flux of migration. This is based on 1990 census data, looking at the migrants arriving in Aceh. And so the first outbreak of the Achenese Declaration of Independence happened around here. It was declared in 1957 and conflict broke out in 1975. Conflict broke out in 1977, but the first insurgency was largely dealt with by 1980. But after this first insurgency, you then see this mass of in-migration, state-sponsored under the Trans-Megalati scheme, which saw relocation of Javanese to many of the outer islands, but actually was one of the hotspots, which was a term that the Indonesian government used, and indeed was specifically identified as such because of the security problems there. And if we look at this Frank Raff looked at the proportion of the migrants who were Javanese, and you can see that particularly in that sort of wave in the early 1980s, it was overwhelmingly Javanese, some 200,000 arriving in 1981 and over 100,000 in the two subsequent years. In contrast, the later wave of migration around here was mostly from neighbouring North Sumatra. In Thailand, there was also a state-sponsored migration scheme, but it wasn't nearly as extensive or successful. These are the provinces of the southern region, and these are the Muslim majority areas in 1960. And we can see that they largely, in fact, increased their Muslim shelter population, with the exception of Saturn, where Muslim assimilation has been more extensive, as I'm sure you're all aware. And this is largely attributed to the higher fertility rates amongst Muslims, which have seen their population keep up or even expand faster than non-Muslim populations. Finally, in our non-separatist case, Sabah, you see two sets of migration. The first has been the influx of Malays from West Malaysia, where we see in around the time that Sabah joined Malaysia, Malays formed around 2% of the population. There were very few indigenous Malays. Now they form around 12% of the population. But the vast majority of the immigration in Sabah has been non-Malay citizens, international migration, which is something distinct about the Sabah case, where you see around a quarter of the population of Sabah now is non-Malaysian, mostly from Indonesia and the southern Philippines, and overwhelmingly Muslim. And this has seen a massive religious demographic transformation in Sabah. In the early years, Sabah was largely divided between Muslims, and the figures here for Christianity are quite low. But the animists, the pagans of the time, were largely a sort of Christian animist overlap. So these two groups were largely combined. So the two political blocks, such as it was, were the Muslims and the non-Muslims amongst the indigenous. And in that sense, Muslims were the minority in 1960. Nowadays, two-thirds of the population almost are Muslim, with Christians forming barely a quarter of the population. This has happened both through migration and through conversion, which has largely been done in the name of development. Essentially, if your village converts, you get a road, was the practice for much of the 1970s and 80s in Sabah. Skipping as quickly as I can. So this is the kind of this migration has led into a twofold process of, I use the terminology of horizontal inequalities, which is a terminology that my research centre in Oxford has been investigating quite extensively, which we're essentially looking at inequalities between ethnic groups, religious groups, regional groups, rather than sort of a traditional idea of what we call vertical inequality, which ranks people individually, the Gini coefficient and such, for people familiar, looking at that inequality between groups defined by something other than their income. And our border work has found very strong econometric evidence of links between horizontal inequalities and conflicts, both in terms of regionally disaggregated studies of the intensity of conflict in one country, particularly in Indonesia and Nepal, but also in sort of cross-sectional studies of multiple countries and the incidence of conflict. The work that I did here was focusing on two dimensions of horizontal inequality. First, looking at the inter-regional HIs, for short, disparities in regional socioeconomic performance between the would-be separatist region and the rest of the country, and intra-regional horizontal inequalities, which is disparities in the ethno-religious, or religious possibly if I've included the L, ethno-religious socioeconomic performance within. And particularly here I'm looking at the distinction between the migrant groups who are loyal representatives of the nation, the titular nation, and the local ethnic periphery. And going back to the quantitative data, I did some work building a model combining this measure of ethnic difference with relative GDP per capita. So essentially looking at the performance at the subnational level of regions compared to the national level, and doing some kind of logistic regression, looking at the incidence of conflict. And I interacted the, if people are interested in the econometrics, I can go into it. But essentially, I interacted the level of ethnic distinction with the socioeconomic performance and some other holding variables, which in this graph I've had at the mean level. So this just shows the sort of the predicted incidence or probability of separatism in terms of relative GDP per capita. So one would be a subnational region, a province or state, which has a GDP per capita the same as the national. 0.5 would be one that has GDP per capita half the national level. I should say it's logged before it's made relative, so half the log GDP. 2 is twice, 3 times is 3, 3 is 3 times the national level. And this is my intention here was to look at, in particular, there's something of a debate in the political economy literature on separatism in whether it's relatively rich or relatively poor areas that are more prone to separatism. And so this graph just takes the model and plots it for various levels of ethnic difference. So this is sort of an area which has a low level of ethnic difference. This is an area that has a reasonably high level of ethnic difference. And this is an area that has a very high level of ethnic difference. And we can see that, you know, when you take this model of conditioning economic performance on ethnic difference, there's a very clear concentration of separatism in both the relatively rich and the relatively poor regions. So in a sense, both stories are right. But what I try to do then in the qualitative work is nuance this a bit with the question of why this kind of relationship, why we can see this sort of U-cut relationship, and I think it's largely one of two sides of the same coin of marginalization and exploitation, and that in some cases around here we see separatism arise in regions which are ethnically distinct and marginalized, economically marginalized. Whereas these regions, many of these regions, we see this GDP per capita is often somewhat misleading because these are regions with very high levels of GDP per capita, but often with very high levels of poverty also. And in particular, the story that, for instance, the Ajanese cow of exploitation does seem to be largely account for the separatist movements that we see clustered up here. So, looking at both inter-regional and intra-regional horizontal inequalities. In southern Thailand, a lot of the literature that's come out over the past few years has suggested that the sort of early waves of violence in the 1950s were linked to socioeconomic marginalization, but that since the 1980s, this has been improving. In fact, the data from the National Statistics Office shows that this just isn't the case. Since 1978, when the GDP is disaggregated by province is available from the National Statistics Office, the relative performance of Narathiwat and Yala in particular has been decreasing quite significantly compared to the rest of the country. Pattani has done relatively better, but all three countries have seen a significant fall in their performance relative to the rest of the country over the past decade. And in fact an absolute fall since the early 1990s, as this graph shows, have been declining in absolute terms. And if we compare particularly with Songkhla, which is the natural border between the Pattani Narathiwat and Yala and the rest of Thailand, but Songkhla was largely spared the effects of the 1997 crisis, which we see here in the overall Thailand performance. So if we look at the relative performance of Songkhla compared to the Malay provinces, I've called them here, the southern three, there's been a real drastic difference in trajectory over the past 10, 15 years. If we look at the regional performance of Mindanao, I mean, essentially it's a story of continuous marginalization, a very poor region before the conflict broke out, despite massive influx of funds under Marcos and post Marcos government to try and buy off essentially the separatist rebellion. Its economic performance has actually declined considerably, and particularly amongst the autonomous region of Muslim Mindanao, which is the four regions where Muslims are the majority, has quite, got a quite staggeringly poor socioeconomic performance, which in terms of human development indices is on a par with some of the worst areas of Africa, very, very low levels of development. Skipping quickly along, actually it's the case where there is very high GDP per capita, but also very high levels of poverty, and this increase in poverty relative to the rest of the country is particularly noticeable during the 1980s, which is after the first outbreak of the separatist movement that was relatively contained, but prior to the re-emergence of it, where it was a much larger widespread movement in 1990. So in that decade of the 1980s, you see actually with a very, very strong performance in GDP, but in terms of poverty rates and also per capita household expenditure, very poor performance in comparison to the national level. So this really kind of confirms the narrative that the Ashanis themselves say of their wealth, essentially their natural resource wealth, not returning to Aceh, it being taken rather to for the benefit of the rest of the country, and as the Ashanis will claim, Java in particular. We see a similar story in Sabah, where GDP per capita has been broadly steady, roughly on a par with the rest of the country. But poverty reduction, and I should say that poverty has reduced remarkably in Sabah, but at a rate much, much slower than the rest of the country, such that in 1970, when the first poverty statistics were available for Sabah, we see poverty at around 50%, both in Sabah and West Malaysia. By 2005, poverty rates were around negligible, less than 5% in West Malaysia. They're still 25% in Sabah. This little asterisk here is a new methodology. So this is under the old methodology, and this is under the new poverty methodology, which makes Sabah's performance even worse. This is a logarithmic scale, so here we're talking around 7 or 8 times worse poverty rates. And at the same time, this has been accompanied by a decline in GDP relative to the rest of the country. Average GDP per capita growth in West Malaysia has been about 6% since 1975. It's been less than 2% in Sabah. That's in real terms. So that's the inter-regional dimension of horizontal inequalities. In terms of inter-regional, we see a similar story in all the regions of local groups on the ethnic periphery losing out in terms of compared to the migrant groups. This is the only data I have for Thailand, and if anyone has more recent data, because this is from 1987, where I actually have the raw data, looking at the distinct differences between different groups in terms of education rates amongst males and females and household assets. This is basically a synthetic measure based on the various questions in the survey about ownership of television, cars, electricity and such, and just generate a scale from 0 to 1 with each asset weighted by the proportion of the population that owns it. And we can see that Muslims, and particularly the Malay-speaking Muslims, rather than those who speak southern dialects, who are mostly in the Pathan province and other provinces, are considerably disadvantaged compared to other groups, and particularly the central Thai-speaking Buddhists. This language here, this is central Thai-speaking and southern Thai-speaking. And I'm assuming, and I'm not sure, this is something people can help me with, but I'm assuming that central Thai-speaking Buddhists, mostly constituted by migrants and possibly by those of Chinese descent, whereas the southern Thai-speaking Buddhists are those of more local origin, but I'm not certain about that. But certainly if that's the case, then we can see that the migrant performance is very much stronger. The only area where these differences are not statistically significant are actually in the rural areas, where the difference between Muslims as a whole and Buddhists as a whole is not statistically significant in terms of assets, which might suggest that a large part of the problem for Muslims has been a failure to penetrate the modern economy. And this is borne out by occupational data, which I don't have here, but which really shows that essentially Muslims are concentrated in the agricultural sector and not in the modern economy in the urban areas. Skipping quickly along, similar trends in Mindanao, where we see this is census data looking at illiteracy amongst Muslims and Christians. and sort of backtrack to this is 1980 census data, the earliest I could get. So backtrack to looking at sort of age cohorts at the age of the outbreak of the conflict in 1972. And we can see that, you know, whilst Muslim literacy rates had increased significantly in the previous years, they had done not nearly as well as the Christians. This is by the time of the outbreak of conflict, the illiteracy rates amongst the age cohorts, the young Muslims who are those obviously who are most likely to be involved in the conflict, were 10 times as high as those amongst the Christian population. And interestingly, if we take this data for 1990 and look at the economic the disparities in educational performance between Muslims and Christians within Mindanao. I'm not sure what happened there. And map that against the level of violence during the Estrada era. There's quite a strong relationship. This is not really, we don't have enough data points. I'm trying to get this down to the municipality level so that we can do something a little bit more statistically significant. But there's certainly sort of indicative evidence, but in fact, the level of violence during the Estrada era when the recent peak of violence was indeed stronger in those areas where the disparity in education between Christians and Muslims was higher. Sabah, a similar story, and Aceh, where you see the essentially Javanese, both in the rural areas, getting much more preferential plots of land, much larger plots of land than the Aceh, as part of this trans-migration scheme. And in the urban areas, Javanese very much taking over the economy in the industrial enclave associated with the natural gas exports and natural gas production in Aceh. In Sabah, a similar story of the local groups, the Kadazan and the Dusun, experiencing marginalisation compared to the Malays, the migrant Malays, and unfortunately this data doesn't have the performance of non-citizens, but certainly compared to the migrants from West Malaysia, performing almost half as well in terms of health and expenditure rates than the migrant population, and the Chinese who are traditionally dominant across most of Malaysia. So this tells the story of a kind of double whammy of marginalisation, both in terms of national marginalisation or exploitation in some cases, in terms of the region vis-a-vis the rest of the country, but also at the local level of local groups being marginalised in relation to groups that are loyal citizens of the titular nation, the dominant ethno-religious group. But this story also holds in Sabah, so this can't, again, give us the whole story. And in looking at sort of the final turn to violence, which I think is very important in this town, and this is where the sort of quantitative work that I've been doing really can't tell any of the story. I mean, what struck me in looking at this sort of final politicization of these grievances to violence, let me step back and say what essentially I think you can see that these demographic and socioeconomic processes generated war-based grievances amongst these sort of ethnic peripheries in many parts of Southeast Asia. But the turn to violence to me seems to be linked to a politicization of these grievances, and particularly a politicization following the intervention of the central state in a way that is perceived as discriminatory and directly acting against that particular group. This is completely different from a different order. But in actually, there was a small-scale rebellion that broke out in the 1970s, but it's really the military repression of the 1980s after that small-scale rebellion that drives the popular rebellion of the 1990s. And you see this with sort of leading Achenese separatists, advocates of peace, but nonetheless separatists like Agnes Rundi, who describes Aceh as a beaten wife, Aceh was married to Indonesia, that they had some problems with their relationship in the 1970s, but that during the 1980s, you know, the husband beat the wife, Aceh, and it was that which provoked the turn to a mass-based movement. Mindanao is a particularly interesting case, I think, because you see in the 1960s, these kind of processes of socioeconomic marginalization, you can link them directly to an increase in violence between Christians and Muslims. So this remains very much localized fighting over land issues as a conflict. So it's fighting between groups rather than against the state. And it's really a series of events in the early 1980s associated with the Marcos regime, which I won't discuss here too much, but which are seen by Muslims in southern Mindanao as being an intervention directly against the Muslims by the state rather than a conflict between Christians and Muslims at a local level that drives the popular movement for separation. And similarly, in Thailand, I think, you know, you can see that the first wave of violence comes as a reaction to Phibun's very strong nationalist measures, which virtually outlaw Malay customs and language practices. The more recent link, Duncan Mercado, this is not my own work, I don't want to claim again, but Duncan Mercado has linked it to the disestablishment of various bodies that emerged during the 1980s to try and channel Muslim grievances. This itself is linked to the contest between Thaksin and Prem, and essentially Thaksin's desire to undermine any of Prem's influence, including in the south. But the repercussion of this was that Muslims lost their voice, if you like, albeit an informal voice for channeling grievances. And then the strong response of the security forces to this, to Muslim protests against this, the stories that we all know of the bans, the suffocations and such. And this is what fed into the return to violence again in the southern. This, I think, is a story that's also told by the report of the National Reconciliation Committee, so I'm very pleased to be agreeing with them. And to sort of what really sparked my interest in this particular sort of role of the state was looking at an alternative case in our non-separatist comparator, the case of Sabah, where in 1985 you see really sort of the height of ethnic discontent in Sabah, a feeling that among Christian Kadazan in particular, that they were being marginalized, that they were being forced to convert to Islam, that Muslims were getting priority in the state, that they were being economically marginalized. There's a state election in 1985, and Muslim parties kind of steal the election. Essentially, they don't win enough votes. It's a very close election, but the Muslim parties slightly less than the majority of the state assembly, but the incoming chief minister would have the power to appoint more senators, and that would bring them over the majority. So they persuade the state governor to install a Muslim chief minister. He then backs down the next day. You then have a period of quite intense protest rallies. You have bombs going off and real sort of the threat of violence. And it's at this stage that the federal government, which has over the past decade very much supported the Muslim parties, very much supported the process of Islamization in Sabah, the federal government intervenes and accepts the non-Muslim victory and repudiates the Muslim parties and in effect gives substantial grounds to the non-Muslim Kadazan. And I do this, it's a very telling difference that at this kind of period where tensions were very high, the state intervened in a way that gave concessions and gave considerable autonomy to the non-Muslim Kadazans in Sabah rather than in our other cases where in similar situations we've seen the state intervene in a way that's been seen as discriminatory and acting against the interests of the local groups. I should say, over the past two decades, they then subsequently and very successfully worked to undermine this initial concession. But at that period of intense political activity, they made the concessions that the other governments did not make. So just quickly, before you all die of boredom, some sort of broad conclusions I want to draw from this, which is to talk about three sort of tenses of separatism. The first is the idea of sort of past perfect. These are my grammatical metaphors. That separatism, unsurprisingly, is associated with ethnic peripheries, often left over from colonial state formation and decolonization. But this is insufficient to explain the incidence of separatism. It may be necessary and not sufficient. So what these pre-colonial ethno-histories can provide is a strong mobilizing potential to atavistic and often glamorized or sanitized depictions of a past glorious age. The second sense of separatism is present imperfect. Demographic minoritization and socioeconomic marginalization and your perceptions of exploitation provide substantial fuel for mass-based grievances, I should say, rather than separatist discontent, but certainly for popular grievances. And this is a nice quote from the original Declaration of Independence from the Free Aceh movement, which I think really kind of summarizes this kind of discourse of colonialism, exploitation, of the modern nation state is nothing more than the next in line of colonial powers seeking to steal their wealth and resources. But the progressive future, the future progressive, the final term to see a progressive future as something that can only be attained as separate and distinct from the existing nation state, it seems to me, has been tied to this intervention of the existing state in directly and deliberately, or ways that are perceived as directly and deliberately discriminatory against local groups. Someone tells me that says thank you, it could say something very rude, but he is to blame if it does. Karim Akesi is my little provocative bit of Yowie or Malay there as well, which is also a language of Thailand.
Okay, thank you, Graham. As Graham said before the presentation, he wants his presentation to be, well, provocative for the audience, and he would like to welcome the question that, you know, you want to know or you want to ask. It's going to be fine if you have a question that's related more to the Thailand case than other, but then, well, let's jump on to the...
With the proviso that my answer will probably mostly be, I don't know.
Yeah, sure. And so if you guys have any, like, things, I mean, any comments or any, like, provocative, question, then, please. Okay.
Thank you very much. I was actually quite struck by your teasing comment on the separatist latitude, or sort of like the global line of separatism at the beginning, and because I sort of heard some other people commenting about these things, the trend towards global history or global phenomenon of separatism. And I was sort of looking forward to hearing more provocative things said about in terms of international relations. And so I would like to ask you to maybe talk a bit more about this, because it seems to be that most of the problem lies in the marginalization of these ethnic and religious minorities within these different areas. But, for example, obviously you have the three southernmost provinces in Thailand, the Pathani case, which is right next to, of course, a major Muslim country, Malaysia, with at least from my point of view, a seriously pro-Muslim majority government policy. And you also mentioned that in other areas, like Mindanao, has a close historical link with Borneo and parts of the present-day Indonesia, and also the other place, Aceh, also has close historical links with its neighboring countries as well. So, could you sort of expand on that a bit?
Okay, yeah, I should have said at the outset, actually, that the sort of international relations dimension of these movements is certainly very important, and I wasn't dismissing its importance. It was more, it took me long enough to tell you what I had on the domestic level, let alone the international level. I mean, I think the international dimension has sort of influenced in a couple of ways. Particularly sort of, not so much now, but particularly during the Cold War era, you saw sort of surreptitious support for various insurgencies in different parts of the world in a kind of us against them basis, particularly in areas of Africa that, you know, both insurgent movements in the Congo, for instance, if a country was seen as broadly pro-America, then the Soviets would sort of support an insurgency there and vice versa, and many of these groups received covert or overt funding and support in such ways. But I don't think this can really explain the incident. It might explain how movements gain access to arms and maybe how they sort of manage to mobilize over a longer period of time, but I certainly don't think international stories can explain the turn to violence. What's more interesting to me is the rather contradictory role of international relations, particularly sort of in terms of local countries, neighboring countries, in terms of resolving separatist issues, both in Southeast Asia and around the world. And we have here, on the one hand, that sort of the international system as a whole, the UN, has been remarkably reluctant to get its hands dirty with separatist movements, and this is sort of largely a part of the old maxim of the UN, which is increasingly being sort of challenged by the particularly under Kofi Annan, the report which I have now forgotten. Important report that was done on the UN's founding sort of objective. But the prior assumption of don't meddle in internal politics, that separatism was seen as sort of, you know, meddling in international internal affairs, and that the UN was for a long time completely ruled out of any of this kind of activity. On the other hand, countries like Malaysia, for instance, in southern Thailand, I mean, I think, you know, I would say I'm no fan of the Malaysian government in many respects. I think I'm not sure what kind of picture you get in Thailand in terms of perhaps a slightly biased representation. The Malaysian government is treading a very careful and difficult line in respect of southern Thailand, in that they are fully aware that many, many people in Malaysia have great sympathy for people who are not only their religious, co-religionist, but in effect co-ethnic. I mean, Malays, the Malay language of southern Thailand is very similar to the Malay language of West Malaysia. And in fact, there are some strong historic links, as you say, particularly in Kelantan, which is one of the northern states of Malaysia with southern Thailand. So the Malaysian government is kind of hamstrung on the one hand by its attempt to, you know, its need to appease outrage amongst Malays in Malaysia with what they see as the repression of Malays in southern Thailand, but also with its relationship with the Thai government and its need to maintain those good relationships. And so both here and elsewhere in the region, Malaysia has very much positioned itself, taken advantage of this kind of dual role to try and position itself as the peacemaker. And it did similarly in southern Thailand, southern Philippines, sorry, where there wasn't the ethnic overlap, but there was the religious overlap. And it positioned itself with relation to Manila as a government that would be able to negotiate between the two, as the kind of, you know, somebody who understood both sides, as it were. But this has by and large not been successful. I mean, the most successful sort of steps towards resolution of any of these conflicts that really have happened in Southeast Asia have been, unfortunately, the tsunami-induced peace in Aceh, and outside intervention has largely been a failure. And I did another paper looking at this, which I will briefly sort of elaborate on. But essentially, I think what happens when you have these kind of internationally mediated arrangements is that they often come to sort of an agreement, and you've seen a series of agreements, the Tripoli Agreement in southern Philippines, which was actually brokered by Libya, again as a sort of third party. Various agreements in Aceh which have been brokered by outside powers. These agreements are often agreed between both sides, very difficult negotiations, but then imposed one-sidedly by the government in question, as sort of whether it's in Jakarta, in Manila, or for that matter in Colombo, in Sri Lanka. Governments have then sort of taken their interpretation of the agreement and imposed it unilaterally. So again, this sort of feeds into this idea that the local population are being, in this case, politically marginalised, that their voice is being sort of hired only insofar as to rubber stamp an agreement. And then, so the Autonomous Region of Muslim Mindanao, for instance, that was created in the southern Philippines, it's a shadow of the institutions that were at least the spirit of the Tripoli Agreement. And we have yet to see what happens in Aceh, but certainly the collapse of the prior agreement in Aceh, which was based around the previous special autonomy law, was largely based on the very weak powers that were given to the Achenese government under the special autonomy law.
Hello, I'm Alta from Human Security Alliance. I'd like to comment on 4 points. Number one, I'd like to know what methodology you have used to select the cases, these 3 cases, excluding some other ongoing separatist movement or amount to the separatist movement in Southeast Asia. Number two, when you are discussing some pre-colonial impact on investigating this separatist movement, would it be better to include also the exclusion from the land of origin, the people, the group of the peoples, particularly in Philippines? Number three, when we are discussing the socio-economic socio-economic impact for separatist movement, what is the better explanation for the impact of economic crisis in Southeast Asia and how it instigated the movement so far? And number four, that is interestingly, the post-colonial, post-Cold War effect in Southeast Asian separatist movement, not only these 3-4 countries, also Burma, and how it relates with the international policy and how actually the international umbrella like UN and other organizations get involved with this kind of situation in terms of negotiation or minimizing the chance for such a movement. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to four points. In terms of the methodology, the selection of the case studies, my main concern. Well, let me say, in terms of selecting the sort of the positive cases, as it were, the cases that were separatist, I was largely here driven by various restrictions rather than positive choice. I would very much like to sort of look at the Burmese movement, but I have no language skills in Burmese, and realistically I had no chance to access Burma. So I thought that was kind of ruled by an alchemy rather, but I'm doing some work with Zani, who's a Burmese scholar activist, and we may be sort of drawing together some work trying to look at how far these kind of processes are the case in Burma as well. The exclusion of the other movements in Indonesia, East Timor and Papua, and East Timor in particular, or Timor-Leste as it now is, I was originally going to be looking at. But I excluded them on a kind of a process of, which actually in the end drove me down some of the lines of investigation I had here, so that their exclusion may have been unwarranted and maybe their re-inclusion in terms of looking at these sort of ethno-histories. Because I thought, this work is part of a larger project which is sort of directed by a board of directors, for want of a better word, at the centre I work for, and they were very keen for me to look at East Timor in the original research design. And my reaction to this was really that I did not see East Timor as a separatist conflict. I saw it as a independent country that was annexed, that resisted annexation for 25 years, but that it wasn't in any sense of the word separatist. And to a similar extent, you could tell the same story about Papua, whose inclusion in Indonesia was rigged, shall we say, rather than sort of voluntary. But unfortunately, when you start down this path, it actually gets very difficult to say, well, what the hell is a separatist movement? Because this is precisely the narrative that you see through many of these movements. Like you see For instance, the Bangsamoro movement in the Philippines, they have this narrative. Jubay Saleh, one of their sort of ideologues of the 1980s and 90s, wrote this book, the Bangsamoro, a nation under endless tyranny. And you know, they really sort of present this story of continual resistance of colonialism, and that maybe the colonial power has moved from Europe to Manila, but it is a continuation of the same resistance rather than, and this is why I pointed to here, that is an extension of the decolonization process rather than separatism. But I think in many of these other cases that I've looked at, you can say that it's not as cut and dried as this, as I see it to be in the Eastern Marines case, okay, that through much of the period of the early Philippines history, you see that many Philippine leaders in Dato are the local leaders in the southern Philippines were largely assimilated into the state. There's a nice quote from Leila Garden-Noble, who's worked a lot on these. She says something that, along the lines that actually prior to the 1972 outbreak of conflict, there were various demands for separatism amongst Muslim leaders in the southern Philippines. But she said something like, you know, they didn't want to succeed, they wanted rewards for not succeeding. So it was kind of this sort of contestation. Actually, it's a particularly clear case where you have a wholehearted inclusion, engagement amongst the religious and political leaders of the immediate post the revolutionary period into the Indonesia project, and even Hassan Tatilo himself, the guru of the Free Aceh movement, Anthony Reed shows this very nicely, that, you know, he tracks Hassan Tatilo's discourse, and that, you know, in the 1950s, Hassan Tatilo was writing, you know, laudatory stuff about the Indonesia project, about how, you know, this was the only future for Aceh, whereas now, I mean, these are his words now, saying, you know, that they are under constant colonial exploitation. So, which is kind of off the tangent of what you said, but essentially my choice of cases was largely driven by the practicalities of where I could do research, where I was familiar enough with the language to be able to work, at least to some extent. And the inclusion of Sabah as my non-separatist comparator has been somewhat problematic. In terms of, this was included largely on the basis, again, of my familiarity with the place. I originally wasn't planning to include a non-separatist case, but I was struck when I started looking at sort of very broad brushstrokes by the similarities of these broad processes with what went on in Sabah, which is an area I know very well because I've long done research in Sabah. So this was really sort of a post hoc inclusion because I thought it's similar processes, and it turns out to be very useful in terms of pointing me, I think, in directions that I might not otherwise have gone. But it's since in other presentations certainly been pointed out to me that it's a bit of a spurious comparator, that if I wanted to do a systematic comparison, and this is something I will hopefully get back to, I maybe should be looking at other non-separatist regions within the same country, because there's so much. I mean, a very simple thing is Malaysia is a federal state, and as I said, you know, the 1985 incidents revolved around local elections, which have an importance in Malaysia that they don't have in many other countries in the region, with the exception of more recently in Indonesia. So whether or not I need to go back and look at, for instance, the non-Thai provinces in the north and east of Thailand, western Sumatra in Indonesia, and other areas of the Philippines, such as the Cagayan Highlands. That's sort of a large extension to the research, but it's probably something that would be methodologically desirable. In terms of the Philippines, I mean, you're absolutely right, the land issue is crucial. What I presented here was very summary data, largely for purposes of speed, but the process of marginalization in the Philippines happened largely through displacement from land, and particularly through the issue of the codification of land, which I think is quite an interesting way in which cultural differences again fed in, that essentially the local Muslim populations in the southern Philippines, like many Malay-oriented groups, or many groups with the sort of larger Malay world, have a concept of land. They essentially don't recognize in their cultural system land ownership. It's always used, land is to be used rather than owned. So when first the American government and then the Christian-dominated government in the Philippines came along and instituted the process of land registration, not only were Muslims unable to, often because of literacy, register for land, often because of literacy levels, but it simply was culturally anathema to them to register for land ownership. So this was a large process of reason why they were so marginalized. The economic crisis is a good question, and I'll have to think about it. I think I don't want to give you a hasty, unthought answer now, so I would rather sort of take some time to reflect upon how it might or might not have impacted on these. I mean, more generally, I think we can say that the impact of the economic crisis was very different from country to country, so we wouldn't expect systematic impacts. One of the interesting things, I think, is that, broadly speaking, the economic crisis didn't impact peripheral regions as much as it did in sort of core regions, because certainly in Malaysia it was largely a fiscal crisis rather than an employment crisis, and that so that the economic crisis had quite a regionally equalizing effect on Malaysia. Well, I looked at the sort of broad regional patterns, but I don't know about other countries, and I would be happy to hear from other people. Interestingly, in Indonesia, sort of feeding into some other research I've done looking at communal violence between Christians and Muslims in Poso, which was not separatist but communal conflict in central Sulawesi. And there the economic crisis had a very direct impact, which was related to the economic segregation, the ethnic division of labor, for want of a better word. But in central Sulawesi, where you have these sort of very amorphous groups, but broadly speaking, Muslim migrant ethnic minorities were railed against Christian local ethnic groups. And whilst there's a very complex patchwork of identities, that was how the conflict became sort of solidified along this line. And what was interesting was that the Muslim migrant groups were largely, although if you look at pre-crisis data from 1985, if you look simply in terms of household income, in terms of literacy rate, there was basically parity between Christians, Muslims, migrants, non-migrants. You couldn't differentiate them at all. The impact of the economic crisis was very perverse, because there was a segregation in terms of the industrial segregation, and in particular that the Christian locals were largely concentrated in the cities, in the port areas, where there was a massive rise in unemployment, whereas the migrant groups were largely concentrated in cash cropping. And with the collapse of the rupiah, they actually gained from the economic crisis. They because the price is set in US dollars. So they were suddenly, you know, this much more lucrative crop. And when we trace the sort of the actual the process of violence in central Sulawesi, the early incidences that sort of fed into then the broad conflict were really possessions of lands. Christian groups, you can trace them going up the mountains and possessing the coca land, the cash cropping land of Bugis Muslim migrants. And this then feeds into the spiral. So there's a very direct link. Post-Cold War effect. I mean, I think, you know, it's hard to say in Southeast Asia, I think, but looking sort of more broadly at the econometric models that I've been looking at for globally, I have tried to break it down by Cold War and post-Cold War era. And I think there's a very stark difference in that. So essentially I looked at this sort of idea of ethnic difference at the local level and subnational economic performance, right? And those were my two main variables that I was interested in, and I interacted them in the regression analysis as well. And it was very starkly clear when you divide it into pre-1989 and post-1989 that whilst the same broad patterns appear, the strength of the interaction term declines in the post-Cold War era and is replaced by a much stronger impact of the pure ethnic factor, which is kind of, I mean, this is the story that a lot of people tell in global terms about the post-Cold War era. It's not one that I'm very happy with, which is why I don't present it, because it seems to be very essentializing and primordialist, but it's certainly the pattern that emerges from the data is very much that that, whereas during the Cold War era, you see this sort of combination of ethnicity and marginalization driving sort of the change towards violence. In the post-Cold War era, the ethnic variable really comes up strongest of all, which, as I say, I find quite dispiriting, and I don't particularly like to present that. But also counterintuitive in terms of, you know, if we assume that the Cold War conflicts were a lot to do with diasporas and international politics, then you would expect, if anything, to see less of a sort of localized importance of local economics, subnational economic performance. So I had to work around it and play with the data to make it tell the story I wanted to, because at the moment it's not a very nice picture, I think.
Doctor, would you, I mean, just related to that last point, would you somehow be able to comment on whether this acceleration of ethnic tribalism since the Cold War period has really been really perpetuated by a feeling of expectation amongst groups that they're going to have a greater autonomy in global affairs, like democratic governance, and also internal self-determination. And this expectation has sort of perpetuated feelings of animosity, growing violence, because there's no obvious remedies available. I mean, internal self-determination seems to just point to the domestic sphere of the majority vote within the entire state, and of course, territorial integrity is a big issue.
I mean, I think, first of all, let me say one thing, which is I think that a lot of the work that's been done on global conflict trends have really sort of undermined the belief that the post-Cold War area is more violent than the pre-Cold War, than the Cold War era, in terms of domestic conflict, civil wars, separatist movements. There was certainly an explosion of violence in the sort of early 1990s associated with the end of the Cold War, and often the collapse of regimes that were largely sort of propped up by whichever pole was supporting them. But since the mid-1990s, there's really been both, if you look at the number of conflicts, the number of fatalities in civil wars, there's been a really quite drastic decrease, such that levels are now at what they were prior to the 1960s and the 1950s. So essentially you see this, I might even have a map, oh no, this is my computer. This is why I said my computer, I can draw up other maps. But essentially you see a kind of a climbing rate of violence in terms of incidents and fatalities, essentially since the end of the Second World War, then a spurt in the early 1990s, and then really quite a drastic fall. So there's, now certainly there's a more sort of ethnic tone to violence in the post-Cold War era. And a lot of people have linked this to the death of ideology. Francis Fukuyama was right in one sense that the ideological battle was over. He was wrong in thinking that this is the end of history. But again, I find this rather unsatisfactory, because the story that's behind it is really, or what I find behind it is this kind of primordial idea of ethnicity as something that was sort of suppressed and hidden by ideology and is now bubbling back to the surface. And it's a very essentialist narrative of conflict, which I find kind of quite disturbing. And it feeds into the clash of civilization idea, which is used by both sides in terms of, when I say both sides, I mean both sort of groups that are in the new clash, the anti-Western groups, where they're Muslim-based as most of them are, and by Americans. I mean, the clash of civilizations as a sort of a legitimizing discourse is great, because it works for both sides. The Muslim groups get to mobilize around it, particularly sort of groups which genuinely do, and I don't think any of the groups in Southeast Asia have strong connections with this kind of global jihad movement that we are supposed to believe in. But those groups where you do see a closer link with global jihad, this provides a very strong strong motivation, and obviously it provides great base for the Republican Party as well. So I think, what you're pointing to is probably very, very important in terms of the nature of territorial politics and the nature of decentralization. Because what you also see, in not so much in Southeast Asia, with the obvious exception of Indonesia, but throughout Africa in particular, in the 1980s and 1990s, and particularly in the 1990s, is really radical decentralization in many countries. which was seen as a way of sort of resolving ethnic tensions, and by and large it hasn't worked. And the reason, and in fact often has fed into ethnic violence, and the reason seems to be simply from looking at the Indonesian experience, is that one of the unfortunate side effects of decentralization is it actually makes it much easier to capture power. And that in a lot of regions in Southeast Asia, in Indonesia, where you saw this communal violence, not so much the separatist violence, but the communal violence in Kalimantan, in Poso, in Maluku. These are all areas where essentially the violence was linked, first of all, to existing economic grievances, but these were mobilized around contestations for local positions of power that in the previous era, first of all, weren't as powerful, and secondly, were just appointed by Java anyway. Now, I'm not recommending a return to the new order at all, but this kind of, particularly sort of this process of democratization and democratization and decentralization in Indonesia really seems to have fed into an ethnic power grab. So now this suggests, certainly in the Indonesian case, it seems to be that this was a wave that for the most part it's over. We see ongoing violence in areas like Poso. But what's been most remarkable about Poso is the resilience of the local population against what are largely provocative attacks, assassinations and beheadings of school children. But the resilience of the population against the return to mass-based violence. So it seems that this has been a sort of a one-off thing, and we can only hope this has been the case. One of my colleagues has done some work on decentralization in Nigeria, not at the state level, but at the district level, which has found very similar trends in terms of the decentralization itself, sort of, first of all, putting more up for grabs. Suddenly these local positions were more power, more important, but also this is why ethnicity is more salient in most countries. In most countries, ethnic differences at the national level are not that salient, in that you have ethnic, obviously, differences in many plural countries, but where the violence emerges is often where the ethnicity is salient at the local level. If you look at a country like Malaysia, I think one of the main reasons that violence never emerged in Malaysia beyond sort of relatively limited incidents in 1969 is because there's sort of a fairly clear no-win situation for ethnic violence in Malaysia. People said the same thing about Yugoslavia, that the Yugoslavia, the presence of ethnic violence in Yugoslavia is interesting because it's one of break-offs. It wasn't a mass war of all against all, it was Slovenia breaking off. Again, actually, Slovenia was a very strong economic performer, so breaking off from Yugoslavia. And then ethnic cleansing in Croatia, as Slovenes and Croats fought, and a spillover effect. So it wasn't a sort of national level war all against all. It was, again, the local level dynamics of ethnicity. So I think there's many people who would disagree with me on that.
Hey, I was wondering looking at the data you were using to measure inequality, what kind of measurements or what kind of variables were you looking at, and whether you were also looking at socioeconomic inequality within those regions. I don't know so much about Indonesia or Malaysia, but especially looking at the cases of Philippines and Thailand, yes, socioeconomic inequality was a major factor in starting and driving these conflicts. But I think what's more important to look at now, how the conflict has created a whole new political economy within those conflict regions, where under the guise of socioeconomic development to, you know, tackle those root causes of the conflict, now that economic development is driving those conflicts, is protracting those conflicts, because now we have a lot of actors within that area who are benefiting from this conflict. And so separatism, it seems, is used, or ethnic-based idealism is used on both sides, the state and the separatist groups, to drive a conflict that they're both benefiting from.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. I mean, in the broader sort of political economy literature on the political economy, let me try to put together a coherent sentence. In the broader literature on the political economy of conflict, there's this sort of been this false dichotomy between this sort of one perspective, which is associated with Paul Collier in particular, as conflict as a as a form of organized crime, essentially profiteering, war motive, anthropological work in Sierra Leone has looked at this kind of motivation, and that sort of the grief discourse is described as, and the grievance discourse, which is what this is largely, this head work is more associated with, is looking at sort of socioeconomic marginalization. But from my perspective, I mean, the conflict that I'm familiar with, there's undoubtedly an element of both, and as you said, I think it's very clear, to my mind anyway, that the greed element that sort of becomes important during the course of conflict rather than being a good indicator, if you like, of the cause of conflict, of the outbreak of conflict. The political economy of war in Southeast Asia and elsewhere is another factor behind that sort of I looked at in the work on the resolution of these conflicts, which I sort of briefly mentioned. And you're right, absolutely, that there's this kind of mutual profiteering, and very often sort of a kind of buying off of individuals, right? So a colleague of mine talks about Noor Misrawi, who was, you know, the leader of the MNLF for a very long time in Mindanao, was made governor of the autonomous region of Mindanao, and then when his term was about to expire and he looked like he wouldn't win re-election, he suddenly returned to violence. And a colleague of mine said, you know, that they gave him a toy house and then threw away his toys. So this is a very important dimension, yeah, particularly in the protraction, I think, and the failure to resolve these conflicts. It's very difficult to know what to do about it, because it's you know, throwing money at the problem doesn't resolve it. The sort of the most positive case we have to look at, if you like, is Aceh, which unfortunately, I mean, you know, I think we can be reasonably certain that you know, a large part of the coming to the table of an agreement of the pre-Aceh movement was simply the horrendous destruction of the tsunami, and the fact that, you know, Aceh as an independent state was no longer viable in the short run. There was very little left to fight for, at least on the west coast of Aceh. Having said that, there's some interesting things in the process of negotiating the settlement in Aceh. The major sticking point is the political one over the ability to run for office at the local level, that Indonesia has a ban on local parties. So if political parties have to operate at the national level, as a lot of other multi-ethnic countries such as Ghana and Nigeria also have similar bans. Whereas the Free Aceh Movement people wanted to contest, if not under the Free Aceh Movement banner, at least be able to contest as either local Aceh parties or Aceh people. And this was the major sticking point for a long time in the constitutional, in the peace negotiations. And what I found interesting is that one of the settlements that was proposed by the Indonesian government and rejected by the Free Aceh Movement was an exemption from this constitutional debarment of local parties for the Free Aceh Movement itself, but for no one else. So in effect, the Indonesian government said, okay, well, we'll let you guys run locally, but we don't want to make this a precedent. And the Free Aceh Movement rejected this, and we said, no, we want anyone in Aceh to be able to run as a Acehese party. Which, I mean, I think, you know, so this kind of feeds back into the green narrative that we need to be also careful about essentializing too much about warlords and green motivations. But if the Free Aceh Movement leadership was driven purely by greed, then one might have expected them to be very happy to settle for, in essence, guaranteed control of the very lucrative position of governor of Aceh. You asked also about the kind of data that they used. I mean, the limitations of doing this kind of large end style work is you have to work with the data that you can get across many countries, and unfortunately that's GDP. And even that's quite limited at the local level. I'm trying at the moment at a more localized level to look at poverty data as well, because there seem to be good time series for most of the Southeast Asian countries actually on poverty, because I think the sort of the largely because a lot of the greed, quote unquote greed, greed hypothesis derives from precisely from GDP data. So actually within the greed framework would be seen as a greed case, because as a confirming case of the greed hypothesis, because it had very high GDP levels. But given that it also had extraordinary poverty, so I want to try and look at this sort of disaggregated a bit in the qualitative work I've done here, which I've only summarised. Unfortunately, I've looked at a variety of socioeconomic indicators, land ownership, education, whatever is available, but that's to tell a narrative story at a local level, if you like. For the broader quantitative cross-sectional work, the best I can hope for is GDP and poverty. But at least that allows us to break the picture down a bit.
From what you just touched on there, it seems to me that you don't think sort of special economy regimes, which are prevalent in a lot of literature today, would really work. The separatism movement and separatism itself is a different beast altogether and won't be happy until it gets its own end goal, and special economy regimes within states are therefore superfluous.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I've had a long debate about it, because Stefan Wolf, who you know, is one of the sort of main scholars looking at special autonomy. I base my conclusions on special autonomy by the cases that I've looked at in Southeast Asia, rather than sort of a more systemic view. And I'm very pessimistic about them. He's done work on, and other scholars have done work on special autonomy and complex power sharing, the idea of complex power sharing, which in somewhere like, for instance, Northern Ireland seems to have created a degree of stability that has been elusive for centuries. Less successful in the Basque region more recently, but it seems to me that when you look at separatist movements and the processes that they go through for special autonomy, there is a question which is left unaddressed, and it may be in the short-term interest of coming to a settlement as a kind of working point, if you like, that special autonomy serves that role. But the fundamental question of what is the nature of the nation state, and what are the nature of these groups, what is their position within the nation state? So, I mean, I will be a bit provocative here and talk about Thailand and say, what role, what position do Malay Muslims have within Thailand? What have they got to, what can Thailand offer them in terms of being, you know, a part of the nation state, subscribing to a monarchy that is very much imbued with a religious mythology that is not theirs, with a historical past that is largely linked to a different country rather than this country. And this kind of question is not addressed by special autonomy. Even somewhere like Aceh, you do not address the fundamental question of why do you want to be part of this country as well as we want you to be part of this country? Now, it might be that special autonomy can offer the and even in somewhere like Northern Ireland, for that matter, I mean, the vast majority of Catholics in Northern Ireland still want to see Northern Ireland as reunified with the Republic of Ireland. Special autonomy, the kind of power sharing arrangements you have, may provide a degree of stability, but it doesn't seem to me that they can be permanent solutions. And indeed, I think there's something very telling in the term special autonomy, because I use special compared to other regions, and this always was Indonesia's problem with special autonomy. If they gave special autonomy to Aceh, they'd have to give it to Papua. If they gave it to Papua, why wouldn't they give it to Riau, which was also separatist in the past? Why didn't everyone get special autonomy? One of the main proponents of a peaceful solution to the problems in southern in Philippines, Augusto Pimentel, Aquino Pimentel, who's a senator, a Christian senator from Mindanao, been very active for a long time in trying to resolve the problem of Mindanao. He himself drafted the bill, the Tripoli Agreement. He was one of the drafters of the Tripoli Agreement, which granted autonomy to the southern Philippines. And he himself has now, in recent years, turned around and become an advocate of the complete reconstruction of the Philippines as a federal state. sort of tries to lead his reason that he thinks that the specialness of special autonomy is counterproductive because it's not permanent and it's not egalitarian across different regions. Now, it may be that federal systems offer a way of giving that degree of autonomy without the kind of provisos of special treatment and the implication that this is not a permanent set of affairs, and this is certainly his argument in the Philippines that the transformation to federalism. I think in Malaysia, federalism played a large role in preventing East Malaysia from going its own way or attempting to go its own way. There's a big debate about this as well, how far federalism is a stepping stone towards violence, because some people have claimed that federalism actually offers a stepping stone for separatist groups, if you like, that it simply encourages narratives of territorial distinction and ethnic narratives. I think there's some very good work by John McGallion and Benjamin O'Leary in Toronto who have shown that this is largely fallacious and based on a misunderstanding of the collapse of the federal systems in the post-Cold War Eastern Europe. So post-Cold War Eastern Europe, the federal countries fell apart. Yugoslavia was a federal country, it fell apart. Czechoslovakia was a federal country, it fell apart. Russia was federal, it fell apart. In contrast, none of the non-federal Soviet states, post-Soviet states of Southeast Asia, of Eastern Europe, have fallen apart. And in fact, one of them has disappeared. Eastern Germany has merged with Germany. But they show quite convincingly that actually what provoked this move to disintegration amongst the East European Federation was the attempt of the centre to impose further central control. So, for instance, in Yugoslavia, it was the rise of the Serbian nationalists and the concomitant withdrawal of autonomy from the region, from the Slovenia, from Kosovo, that provoked the turn to violence in these countries. Similarly, in Russia, it was the reassertion of Muscovite hegemony after the relative laxity of the immediate post-war era that saw the Chechen outbreak of violence. So, right, personally, I mean, this is rather a combination of political analysis and political science, I would say. But I see federalism as a very promising way of combining territorial, authentic demands for territorial integrity at the local level with the nation state. Because I think you can say about very many of these separatist movements, I should say, that actually they're not viable. There's a kind of very practical thing that they're not viable as independent states. I don't think Southern Thailand would be viable economically in the long run as an independent country. I mean, we just have to look at East Timor, which is really struggling to block out a viable path for its own development, despite the fact that it's got massive oil reserves that it had its back. So many of these separatist countries are not from the sort of rather, I'm a Western development scholar telling you what to think perspective, but it seems to me that they are not viable economically in the long run. So federalism maybe offers a way of sort of providing both the socio-economic benefits of being integrated into a larger national system with the genuine concern for autonomy and cultural recognition. Doctor?
I have a few questions to ask. This is related to special autonomy. What would be, as you mentioned earlier, about the option would be federal government. What would be the criteria for special autonomy if power sharing is agreed on the table? Looking at the situation in Indonesia, Aceh was given special autonomy. West Papua was given a special autonomy in 2002 as well, similar to the situation in Aceh, but the low-level tension is still growing or still happening in West Papua, despite the separation of the few provinces. And I tend to argue with you about this, they are economically inviolable in the future, but I'm looking at Aceh as Luxembourg, for instance, is the petroleum and gas-producing province, and coal mining, perhaps, in West Papua is a lucrative business, and it's controlled by an American company. And I'm also looking at Southern Thailand as a viable commodity for oil and gas processes. So, what would be the criteria for a special autonomy for Southern Thailand and perhaps power sharing?
Okay, first of all, in terms of West Papua, I mean, I think you have to make a very important distinction between the special autonomy that there is in Papua and the current state of Achinese autonomy. Because the special autonomy law that was passed and implemented in 2001-2002 for Papua has not been implemented. And in particular, the Majlis Papua, the local government that was going to be set up, derived from local Papuans, which was going to have a veto over such things as the creation of new provinces, has not been created. And in fact, the division of Papua into three provinces, which kind of has happened, or maybe it hasn't happened, no one really knows, this is unconstitutional under the special autonomy law, because it requires the acceptance of the Majlis, which has not even been set up. So in terms of not ameliorating local grievances, this could partly be why. But I think this was part of the point I was trying to make earlier, and I think that in many cases, special autonomy packages are very carefully agreed, very carefully negotiated. There's a very fine balance in Tripoli, in Jeddah, in southern Philippines, in other places. And then the central government bulldozes in and implements it the way that it sees fit. So this is why I'm kind of quite skeptical about the practice of special autonomy, if not the theory. I'm willing to accept that maybe as a kind of theoretical period, as a sort of an ideal type, special autonomy may be a way to generate stability. But as I said earlier, I don't think it provides a permanent answer to this kind of problem. I mean, I was being a bit flippant when I said that, you know, these places are not economically viable. Actually, as you say, has got vast natural gas resources, although dwindling. I mean, they are dwindling fast. And actually, you know, natural gas is no guarantee of economic success. I mean, the resource curse is a well-known phenomenon in development economics, right? And again, we have to look at East Timor to see, you know, that the natural resource has been by no means a blessing yet for East Timor. Maybe it will be in the future. More broadly, there's a problem with the way in which this kind of thing legitimizes the violent claims for ethnic identity, and I think you're seeing a bit of that in East Timor now as well. And also in Aceh, where there's now, you know, emerging tensions between the ethnic Achenese and the Gayo Highlanders. In East Timor, you see sort of this political com-regional division between Fretilin and Shanana Gusmao, which also roughly corresponds to the eastern and western ethnic groups. And a large part of this, you might be able to say, there's a kind of a legitimizing effect of special autonomy on this kind of politics. And in Aceh, there was, in the immediate post tsunami period, where, you know, this really sort of inchoate period where it seemed like things were moving forward, a lot of people who were displaced and suffered massive personal trauma and economic loss because of the tsunami, were expressing incredible outrage that their compensation payments from the government were some tenth of the amount of money that former GAM former GAM fighters were being given to give up their weapons. And people were saying, in a sense, you know, better I go and get a gun, and then I can, you know, I can multiply my income 10 times. So it's this kind of legitimizing discourse of how you end, how special autonomy ends violent conflicts. I think if you have a more sort of national compact in terms of a revisiting of the social compact that underlines the nation, including its ethno-national, religious national underpinnings, then maybe this is, you know, a better way to resolve these issues. So, but I'm not a fan of special autonomy at all, I'm afraid. So if you ask me under what conditions, I would say very, very stringent conditions.
Can we make it the last question, please? Oh, if there is any.
I think in southern Philippines, especially for the AIMM, the Reynolds Region and Muslim Mindanao, I think the government in the Philippines did pretty well, gave a lot to Norm Misuari, but then Misuari just screwed up. I mean, you know, millions of funds were allotted from Mindanao, but then Norm Misuari, you know, he doesn't know about governance, he screwed up a lot, there was widespread corruption. That's why Manila decided to, you know, replace him by choosing another candidate. So I think it still boils down to who runs the autonomous government. So if the people running the autonomous government are competent, I think it will work. But in the case of Mindanao, I think Norm Misuari screwed up big time. That's why it failed.
I mean, I think certainly, yeah, Norm Misuari was as you say, he screwed up. And this fits back into the previous comment about the political economy. I mean, you say he screwed up, then he ends up in jail, but certainly, you know, he made probably a fair amount of money for himself and his mates during that period. But even so, I think, you know, the autonomous region in Mindanao, it falls far short of what was agreed in the spirit of the Chatelet agreement and in the Jeddah agreement as well. And, you know, you see a lot of groups that didn't, the MILS, you know, they rejected it precisely for this reason, that it didn't go far enough in offering autonomy. Now, again, you know, this overlap is very difficult to distinguish, so in some cases people use this, for instance, the Afro-SIAC group largely used this as a legitimizing discourse, you know, where we didn't get enough autonomy for what is essentially basically an extortion-based group of pirates. So yeah, okay, I should nuance things and say it won't both ways. But again, there's a problem that, and you see this to an extent in that case as well, that war leaders are often not good peace leaders, right? And you know, in Aceh, I was sort of in Jakarta around the times of the governor elections, and all the World Bank people and all the UNDP and the local governments, they were saying, you know, oh, Gam will never win the election, you know, people are tired of them. And I was sat there thinking, come on, these guys, you know, they won. I mean, they might not have won independence, but, you know, they're the heroes of Aceh, of course they'll win it. I was right, they were wrong, but that was a different matter. But the thing is, again, these guys, you know, are they really necessarily going to be good administrators? So you have a kind of problem again with, if you offer special autonomy and the people who are naturally going to take up that kind of leadership role are those who have been involved in fighting what are very protracted wars. And I mentioned earlier, you know, separatist wars, the average length of a separatist struggle is 15 years compared to 7 years for other forms of domestic civil war. So people have spent their entire lives fighting, essentially. Whether they're going to make good administrators or not is another question. Northern Ireland's interesting, and maybe this is a case where you have sort of another case where you have this parallel military and political hierarchy, and a gradual transfer of power from the military wing in the IRA to the political wing in Jerry Adams and the Sinn Féin. And to an extent you have that obviously with the Free Acting Movement and the AFMLS, but they were, you know, living over in Stockholm and really divorced from reality for a long period of time, from the Estonese reality, I should say. But you're right, yes, certainly, I mean, no, Swami was a bit of an idiot.
Okay, so I would like to end the official session now, and if you guys have any more questions, I think I will be welcome to answer, like, anything better. Okay, and Graham, there's, like, a person from the study.
Where actually we have the southeast camera. So maybe if there's a it might. I'm not really sure what kind of solution.
I think a kind of particular case where you have a sort of myth, if you like, which
I see any kind of place of a special economy.
International phenomenon. The force from like the world, especially the Western country, human rights, like that. There's a West Papua
Separate.
Separate.
Yeah. Thank you.